shot in the dark. So every sort of spark, I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 259. Got Calyx on the road, so you get Counterposition on the road. I am in the promised land, the great metropolis of Flint, Michigan. I know you listen to this. If you're not a listener to the show, you say, what the promised land? What are you talking about? You know, I've got some thoughts about that, about the reduction of Flint, the reduction of places and the reduction of people, but I'm going to hold that off. Oh my goodness. So, be forewarned, I'm a little out of it. not a lot of sleep in the last few days. Just, I'm road weary. I was trying to get ready to leave and trying to work and trying to do everything before I got out of town. And, I'm on about three nights in a row of about two thirds or about half of the amount of sleep I need. I feel pretty good though. Earlier today, man, I had the worst sinus headache. I was in a meeting and I was just like sitting there in my head. I felt like I had concrete sitting on my optic nerve. And I've had bad sinuses since I was a kid. I used to just take those little red pseudoephedrine things like Tic Tacs when I was a little kid. And thanks, Mom and Dad. Inherited it from both sides. Mom and Dad both get like crazy bad sinus headaches. And so it seems like when I get on the road sometimes, up here in Michigan, it tends to happen. I think part of what it is right now is that when I have sleep apnea, so I sleep with one of those CPAP machines, right? And my machine back home has a humidifier, a little heated humidifier, but I don't drag that with me because it's a little heavier, takes up a little more room. I don't drag it with me when I travel. And I'm starting to think I'm going to have to just like start carrying an extra bag. And you know, you can take it on for free. It's medical equipment. And because man, I think I just get so dried out, and I just get completely just like my head becomes concrete. And then I have to go through this horrible ritual of taking sinus medicine, taking a hot shower. Usually makes me throw up, and then I have to taking more sinus medicine, take another hot shower, and in between laying in a dark room, usually not vertical, not horizontal though, because that makes pressure on my head. It's like it's the same little ritual I've had since I was a little kid. But I was able to get out of that meeting, you know, after the meeting was over. I managed to make it through the meeting, and I got back to the rectory I'm staying in for this project, and did my little ritual with the hot shower and everything, and I took a nap, and I tell you what, man, the combination of post-headache trauma, which just destroys me, and not having slept, I went down for like a 45-minute nap, and it was literally, I looked at the software that I track my sleep with, and it was like off the cliff, zero movement, like in the grave, and then I woke up. For about 48 minutes, it was just like, it's a one sleep cycle that was just nothing but me in the grave. So I kind of have that feeling like I just woke up this morning because I'm still kind of groggy from the sinus medicine and stuff. So if you hear frequent sips of this beautiful Ethiopia Limu that I brought with me from Commonwealth Coffee, you'll know why. This is like I'm recalling stories of trauma today. For the start, sounds like it's not going to stay that way. Things got better, but man, yesterday, I'm going to be honest with you. I normally have a pretty good time getting out of town. I'm very leave early and get there. I'm late for everything under the sun except for when I go to the airport. I always get to the airport early. Well, now, you know, I've got this TSA pre and the clear, and so I just have to get there, you know, you know, I mean, if I hit the airport right about when my flight's starting to board, I'll make the flight no problem. Because you just walk, you basically walk right through security. No waiting. But, which, by the way, if you travel a lot, I know I've said it before. I'd like to publicly thank Chris Stefanik, who is a road warrior par excellence. And that was his, when I asked him for travel hacks, his very first, especially from Denver, his very first thing was get both clear and TSA pre. I know it seems redundant on the front end, but just get them both. And I tell you what, I want to publicly thank Chris Stefanik for telling me that. It's the best $155 I ever spent, clear. Absolutely amazing. Anyway, so I actually had a drama-laden trip to the airport, but it was because I was trying to help out. So I brought Katie Heil from Tatanga Bamoy up here with me to meet the people doing the Catholic Worker Project, and there's a social entrepreneurship kind of incubator up here, and I want her to bring some insights that she got from the Congo from doing Tatanga Bamoy, which is a really great great project. If you need Christmas gifts, and well, it's almost Christmas, so of course you do. They make incredible bow ties and neckties from this gorgeous batik fabrics in the Congo, and then they sell them in the Congo, and then she sells them in America and shares the profits with the ladies that do the sewing in the Congo. And it's really helping transform some people's lives, but it's a business. It's a social entrepreneurship business. They also have head wraps, which a lot of ladies like to wear. They like them, but they've really gotten popular, and because they're so festive and they're so vibrant and they're so living, and so people who want to cover their head because they've lost their hair or had to shave their hair because of cancer, have really loved these. So God forbid if you have anybody in your world that is in that position, this might bring a moment of kind of joy in their life to give them something so vibrant and colorful and beautiful to wrap around their head, you know. So I'll put the link to Tatanga Bamoy in the show notes today. And I would really encourage you to grab a bow tie, grab a tie, grab a head wrap or something, grab several for people in your life, because you're really transforming lives. But anyway, and Katie's such a spectacular individual, such a really amazing woman. So anyway, there's an impromptu commercial for Tatanga Bamoy. So I had Katie with me, and I was meeting her at Union Station, and we were going to take the train to the plane, right? And I knew I would kind of get in. I'd be getting there way early, but, you know, cool. So I get down to Union Station, and she's on the train, and she said, they said it's running a little behind because of a track problem. And I'm like, well, okay, hold on. So I was just grabbing some coffee and trying to look up, you know, what the options were as far as the bus that I used to take to the airport, or, you know, maybe should we, like, you know, call emergency and just kind of, like, you know, get a pay the extra and get a Uber and go out there or something, because, you know, it's going to be cheaper than changing a flight. And right as I was about to text her and say, hey, just get off the train. Let's take a – you're running kind of close. Let's get you out there. I want to get you an Uber. Let's go. I get a text from her saying, left. So poor Katie. So I managed to just – I turns out there was like an over an hour delay on these trains because of a broken track or something. I ran the numbers and said, you know what, I'm going to take an Uber. And so I got an Uber and went to the airport, and Katie got halfway, and they took them off the train. And this is, like, you know, bad form, Denver, by the way, publicly calling you out. They took 50 people off this train and put them on a train platform and then left them there for 30 minutes. Now, mind you, it was 1 degree outside. One, as in uno, as in dos minus uno. Yeah, just like one degree, one above zero, one. And they left these people out in the cold for 30 minutes. Katie, God love her, doesn't have a drop of extra meat on her bones anywhere. And, I mean, she was half frozen. Her phone stopped working because it was so cold. And she was pulling socks out to use as mittens and stuff. And they just left these people out in the cold for 30 minutes. And she finally managed to get an Uber that was in a weird place. It popped up on her. She got her phone working and was able to get an Uber and got to the airport. And I was like, my goodness. I mean, it's just nuts. So in the end, and then I got there all the way to the gate, and I was following her movements by text. And she, that poor thing, was froze half to death. They put like four or five people in wheelchairs, like kept putting them in front of her in security. And then she had to run, I mean, sprint through the airport. And she made it like in the minute after the last possible minute, I got on to hold the door open and get her in. So, yeah, it was, it was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Just, I love that movie, and it just the title described it perfectly. It was Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. But oh my goodness, drama. All right, so no more drama. I met two remarkable individuals on my way in to Flint, and I want to talk. I just want to tell you both of those stories real fast. And then I've got some more stuff up my sleeve. So, I'm trying. Now I got to look up the one of the two guys' names. I'm spacing. I have to look it up during the break. But my Uber driver was somebody really interesting. And I met someone in the airport in Flint that was doing something they're amazing at. So let's go to the break, and I'll tell you about them when I get back. You're listening to The Counterposition.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lip my blood. The only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. Slurp. Sorry, I forgot to take a big drink before I started the show. It's the second segment. Got to get woke up here. I took an Uber. I've never taken an Uber to the airport because it's expensive, quite honestly. It's like $50, you know. And I can take the train for $9, and I love just kind of the, ever since I was in Austria, going from the little station out in Treiskirchen into Vienna and back, I just kind of got a feel for that, oh, trains, I mean, there's something to this, and you know, and I know people that are on the coast are just used to using trains, or like, or even like Chicago or something, they're like, yeah, it's normal, but I'm from a small town in the Midwest, you know, and to me, taking public transportation has always been taking the bus, which is something you only do in desperation, and it's not exactly just, it's not the same experience. You're just going slow, and you're stuck in traffic, except you have no control because you're not behind the wheel, and there's just, you know, buses are, you know, it's just bus. But I don't like buses, I do like trains. But it was nice. I mean, I take Ubers fairly frequently. I live just far enough from downtown in Denver that the average Uber cost is low enough that it's usually cheaper than parking, where the combination of Ubering down and back home is about the same or just a buck or so over what it would take to park, and parking is an absolute pain in the butt in downtown Denver. So I love just meeting people and talking to them. I thought about becoming an Uber driver. I thought about, like, getting that set up. So, you know, make a little extra money, just drive around, meet some people. If you listen to the show, you know I love meeting random people and talking to them. So, I mean, I'm going to be a little extra income. I like going for rides. I like just driving around. And I like talking to random people. So, I don't know. If you're ever in Denver and I pick you up in an Uber, you'll know I pulled the trigger on that. My car would use some work, though. So I get in this Uber downtown. And now in hindsight, I mean, I really super feel for Katie in that 30 minutes in the cold, because I was out in the cold for about 3 to 4, maybe 5 minutes. And I have substantially extra padding and nerve keeping me warm all over myself. And, I mean, my little pinky on one of my hands that was holding the phone was, like, freezing. Like, I couldn't feel my finger. I mean, it was like, and so I was like, I could not feel my part of my hand. And she was out there for 30 minutes, but I don't want to go back to the drama. So this is when the good stuff happened. So I was talking to this guy. So this guy picks me up. His name is Jeremy. And he's a really nice guy, real positive, got a great attitude, really, really, really accommodating, very hospitable, you know, good, just good Uber driver, you know, picks me up. And takes me, you know, we get out on the highway, and I'm going to guess he's probably in his late 20s, you know, young black man. And we start talking, and we end up talking about he's from Mississippi, I'm from kind of near the South. And we start talking about the difference between kind of the race relations in the South and what it's like to be out here in the West, you know, be out in the West in Colorado. And I told him the story that I told you about on the show about being in the steam room down at 24 Hour Fitness. Turns out he works out at the same 24 Hour Fitness I do. And so he knows the steam room I'm talking about. And I told him the story, and we were just talking about how, you know, he was perfectly comfortable talking. I was perfectly comfortable talking, and we talked about kind of how people in public spaces and how in environments we kind of we make assumptions, or we kind of we were uncomfortable if anyone brings up the topic of race and stuff. And it was a great example. I'm always going, the reason I'm telling you about this, and the only reason I mentioned that the guy was black is because I'm white, and I'm obsessed with the idea that people need to talk to each other, and we need to acknowledge differences in culture, ask each other questions, kind of have conversations. And so this guy, I started to say this kid, he is kind of a kid, you know, anybody over 30 at this point, I'm getting old. Much this kid, you know, turns out he played ball for Texas A&M. And then, so he was an Aggie for a year, and he ended up playing for CU Boulder. And he's got his master's in industrial psychology, and he's working on his PhD. So I did think, you know, it's interesting. Here's this young guy. He's clearly kind of like, he's very athletic, you know. You know, he looks like a basketball player. And so it's funny. I just love the stereotypes. He's a young black guy dressing kind of like, you know, kind of cool athletic gear. And he's obviously kind of athletic, the way he carries himself and the way he's built and the way he moves. And in our society, you know, you would think, oh, okay, he's a young black man. Okay, then there's these assumptions that people would make, right? And then he's an athlete. Okay, then there's assumptions that go on and on with this because he's an athlete. You know, he must be a dumb jock, or he must be this or whatever. These different people have these different assumptions about people. And then I just love it. I love when people are the kind of people that would defy people's assumptions when they make stupid assumptions. And here's this really vibrant, really intelligent, really, really just quick on his feet, well-spoken, amazing, hard-working young man who's getting his PhD. And he went through the process of playing ball to get, and he was telling me how he's like, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm working on my, I'm starting my PhD, and I don't have any, you know, I don't have student loan debt or anything. And I'm just like, man, I just want to give the guy a high five. I gave him a five. I tipped him a five for taking me to the airport. But the guy was super nice. He's out there just making him some money, going to starting his he's 1 year into his PhD program. It's just a really remarkable individual. And so I was just it was interesting. It was just a good conversation. I love meeting people like that in such a random place. Now, Ubering is one kind of work that you meet when you're traveling, right? Uber drivers. And they're usually, I have seen an exception, they're usually not the people that are like, man, I just love doing this. Man, I used to be, you know, I have met a guy that had been a cab driver his entire life, and he was using his own car, and the guy just like, he's like, I can go out of my way and be even more hospitable and take care of people and stuff. And the guy was the best Uber driver I'd ever had. And he was just like, he was like a concierge or something. And the guy just like was full of information, was checking stuff on, was checking things. He checked. The guy asked me where I was going at one point. Cause I was going, I think it was the other time I was taking a short hop to, oh, I was going to, to catch the train for the airport. And the guy asked me a couple questions about where I was going, and at a light, he was talking to me and kind of checking his phone. And he's like, yeah, your flight's on time. You know, like he figured out based on what I had told him, you know, and the time that the flight was leaving, what flight it was. And he checked it on Google and told me that my flight was on time. You know, I'm like, man, well done. That's pretty awesome. I mean, just really took care of it. Most of the time when you're meeting people that are Uber drivers, they're just doing it because they're doing something else. And the interest is finding out what else they do or who they are. Like Jeremy, who's getting his PhD in industrial psychology and who played ball for A&M and CU. What a cool guy. But sometimes when you travel, you get to observe or you get to meet someone. I told you the story about the guy that was just, I got a first class upgrade at one point, and I was in that seat where you could see into the galley, and I did part of a show talking about how amazing this guy was at what he did, right? And how he just had all these little, he didn't waste a movement, he just had it down. It was such, you know, service in such a constrained environment, and he was able to do something so beautiful and so well there. Well, I got to Flint, you know, which is funny. I was changing planes in Chicago. I realized that my HR guy from the Augustine Institute, Tim, and Mark Middenmore from Lighthouse, and I can't remember the other lady's name, is one of our workers in Chicago, so I've only met her like once. They were on the same plane as me. I didn't see them. They came. So it's kind of funny. You're like standing in Chicago, Illinois, and you're waiting on someone to get off the plane. And people that you were at a Christmas party with in Denver come walking off the plane. But I got on the plane, and we landed in Flint, Michigan. And that Flint, Michigan airport is a really great airport. It's just tiny. And I like tiny airports because you can just get stuff done quick in a tiny airport. And people are usually a little more human. Now, that being said, as far as tiny airports go, that's not always the case. It's not always easy. The Tri-Cities Airport in Washington, Pasco, Kennewick, Richland, that Tri-Cities Airport out there, craziest experience I've ever had. It's like entering Israel, leaving that airport. I mean, it's like, they were tearing apart bags, questioning everyone. I mean, it seemed like they were kind of profiling. I mean, it was like, they weren't even really profiling. They were just questioning everyone and tearing bags apart. They took my bags apart and looked in them and everything. And it turns out I was really getting furious because I was about to miss my flight. And I would have if it hadn't have been delayed. And finally a TSA person was like, look, man, there's a nuclear facility nearby. There's a nuclear plant, like, right near this airport. So if you were going to basically steal a plane and try to run it into a nuclear plant, this is the airport in America you would choose. And I'm like, oh, well, why don't you just tell me that, you know? All right, I ran out of time. So I'm going to tell you about the other amazing individual that I met. When we get back from the break, you're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then how we crave a hanging in its dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Be boasting and please don't stink. but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so I was about to tell you about another amazing individual that I met while traveling and yesterday, and I got distracted and went on a bent about Tri-Cities Airport and Eastern Washington. I'm telling you, though, I mean, I used to pay extra at times to fly in and out of Santa Barbara instead of LAX and all that, because it's so easy. Small airports are normally just like a breeze. Flint here, I mean, you can get there without TSA pre or clear or anything and still make your flight fast. I mean, it's because they're small and there's just, you know, there's a minimal amount of infrastructure you need and security and all that. And for any airport, and that's kind of more than enough for a small airport like this, right? Pasco, Kennewick, Richland, not the case. If you're ever flying out of that airport, give yourself like an extra hour, even though it's tiny. Anyway, so I came into Flint, tiny little airport, and I got a text about an event we were going to go to, and it was It was kind of like people were going to have jackets on and kind of maybe suits and, you know, it ended up being not that crazy formal, but I didn't really, well, wasn't prepared, and I don't travel with a suit unless I need one. And so, I had meant to get a shoe shine at the airport because my shoes were kind of looking pretty beat up and I didn't get to do so because of all the travel drama. So Katie needed to go get her bag, and I didn't think our ride was going to be there anytime soon. So there was a little shoe shine stand there, and a guy's sitting there bored, nothing to do. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get my shoe shined. You know, I need that done. I love getting shoe shine. It's in the airport, and I'm like, you know what? I was going to have to go home and like ask one of these priests. I go to the rectory and ask one of these priests for black shoe polish, and I was going to have to do it, and it was going to take me forever, and I was going to worry about getting polish on the carpet or something. I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to get this done. And so I sat down, and this old guy named Joe, or Jose, he's originally from South Padre Island, and he's lived in Flint, Michigan for 39 years, and he's been polishing shoes at that airport for 38 years. 38 years. That dude, this guy has seen, he's been just popping when this city was just at its peak. And it had the highest per capita income in America. This was Buick Town. This was GMC. I mean, it was like, this was a really vibrant, prosperous city. And he was a shoe shine guy, you know, at the airport. And he's been polishing shoes there for 38 years. Now, if you don't, there was a time in my life when I would have said, man, that's a shame that guy got stuck doing manual labor for 38 years like that. But this guy was just like, I mean, he took such amazing pride in his work and he was so knowledgeable. So I have black Birkenstock Londons, right? So German shoes. And he started polishing me. He's like, man, this is really nice leather. I really like working on leather this nice. This is beautiful leather. Thank you. And the guy thanks me for letting him polish his shoes because he doesn't normally get to work with leather this nice. And he's like, yeah, he says, you know, where are these shoes from? And I told him they're German made. They're Birkenstocks. And he was like, yeah, this is English leather, though. He goes, and he could tell by working with it, like the finish and the way it's made, this is English leather. And so I'm going to look it up, see what Birkenstocks are made out of. I bet he's right. But he said, oh, this is English leather. And so then he pulls out this huge can of black wax. And I'm like, man, that's a serious tub of wax. And he goes, oh, yeah, I make my own. So the guy over the years has developed his own formula and he makes his own shoe wax, his own polish. He makes his own shoe polish. And it was like, he says, yeah, he's different than anything you've ever seen here. Try pushing on this. And he puts a little, he puts a towel over the shoe polish and lets me push on it. And it's just rock hard, this polish, you know? And so we're talking a little bit and he says, I said, well, you should sell it. He goes, well, I'm working on a contract for the U.S. military. He says, yeah, I got voted best military shoe shine in America. And he points this little plaque that I couldn't see because it was right behind me. And sure enough, there was a letter that that he got voted. I guess a bunch of people in service voted from their experiences, and he got voted the best military shoe polish in America. Like being the best shoe polisher and having the best actual polish. I'm not sure which one it was, but and he sells it right there. You can buy some of this black shoe polish from him at the Flint Airport. And so I told him about my friend Tim Goodrich that I met out here, and he has a Sutorial, and he makes beautiful handcrafted boots. Takes 25 man hours, costs $500 for a pair. You're probably going to wait for months if you order some because he's backed up because they're so beautiful and so good. And I told him, so I told him about Tim and these amazing boots that, you know, if you just resole them and take care of them, you'll pass them down to your grandkids. And they're just the real deal. And he was like, man, I could send him customers. I'm like, well, you know, because you need a way to sell this stuff online because he didn't have it online. So I took his card and I'm going to give it to Tim. But it was interesting. So long story short, he puts this wax. He does all the kind of typical stuff, and he puts this hard wax on my shoe. And I tell him that when my dad taught me how to polish shoes, my dad always sets the wax on fire to soften it up and then puts it on the shoe. And he says, ah, yeah, I got that cover, but I do it different, and this works better. And so he puts this hard wax all over my shoes, and then he gets a little heat gun out, like you would use to strip paint or something like that. And he kind of holds it back, and it like warmed my feet all up. And he goes, oh, yeah, my customers love this in the wintertime, you know. And he heated up my shoes, and then he went in and did some stuff, and then he pulled something out. And he's got this, like, he had like a bracelet made out of like canvas and Velcro and stuff. And he wrapped this polishing rag around his hand a couple times and threw a finger and all this, and then stuck it under that, and then used his teeth to kind of like lock it down. And he had this like crazy like hand wrap thing with this band holding it in place. And he just went to town on my shoes and polished these shoes and did this stuff. And man, it was they looked amazing. And they didn't have like any crinkles in them like when they bent or anything. And to this day, it's been a couple days and I've been running around and I've scuffed them and stuff and everything. These shoes still look great. He says, yeah, that shine will last a long time. And so why am I telling you all this? Because I'm a big deal and I stop and get my shoes shined. I know. It's that here's a guy that has been doing something that someone else would consider menial and not work that would be dignified. He's been doing it for 38 years. And you don't get the feeling that he was like, yeah, I live to shine shoes, you know. He would like to sell his wax and his shoe polish and make some money and stuff and take it easy. He's been, you know, polishing shoes for 38 years. But the guy just carries himself with so much dignity. It reminded me, I had a mechanic in California. It was an Argentinian guy. Can't remember his name. And he's just like, you know, got his gray, blue uniform on or whatever, you know, oil and stuff on him. I mean, but the way he carried himself, the way he was groomed, the way he spoke, the way his posture, the way he carried himself, you'd have thought the guy was a king or something. You'd have thought he was a prince or something. He just had all this dignity about himself, and he did what he did. He did it well. And he was proud of what he did, and he was glad to serve you by sharing his knowledge and talent with you. And that was the dignity that he found great dignity in that. And he imparted it to you like you wanted to you wanted to work the way he worked when you met him. And I had that feeling again when I met Jose. He's a good dude. So I took his card. I took two of his cards. One to give to Tim Goodrich. And if I get a chance to get out of here on time, I already talked to him. And if I can get out early enough on Monday, I want to pull my gear and do a couple segments of interview with Joe. Another thing that really hit me about Joe is there was a couple of things I was telling him about. Katie came out of the restroom, went down to get her bag, and I was telling him who Katie was and the trouble we'd had on the other end with the cold and the train breaking down and all that. And that triggered a very personal moment. He told me something about his wife and about their marriage and some regrets that he had and stuff I'm just some guy getting my shoe shined. But we started speaking, and he could tell that I was having a personal interaction with him. And he opened himself up to me, just a stranger. And that's another thing that I really admire. Both of the guys I met, Jeremy the Uber driver and Joe the shoe shine guy, do something that I instinctually do myself. As if I start making a connection with someone across the counter from the counter position, I will be fairly quick to, you know, kind of sell my heart on my sleeve and open up and be very even personal and vulnerable when if a real human engagement happens in conversation. And that I appreciate too. I also appreciate having this show paid for. So let's go to the break and let you listen to some commercials. You're listening to The Counter Position.
Then all the colored glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to see. Love addicted myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm dope.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, the final lap. Man, I thought I did. I was worried I didn't have enough to do a show today. Maybe I didn't have enough, you're thinking. maybe I should have found something better to talk about. I'm talking about the things that I care about in this world, and if you listen to this show consistently, I think you must care about some of the same things I care about. Coffee. Is one of them. So you know what is so funny, man? We went to, they said we're going to go out to dinner, and then they said we're going out to this golf club to go to dinner last night. And this donor was wanting to take us to this thing. And then it turned out like an event they have there. I don't know if it's a fundraising event or whatever, but I was told they had a raw bar. Now, I'm from two places. I'm from a very small town, Southern Missouri. If you said raw bar, I would have no idea what you were talking about. Depending on the time of my life, I have no idea what I would think. Maybe I thought you were talking about some sketchy entertainment happening at a bar or something. But in California, I mean, I lived in California. You say the word raw, you're talking about salad and, vegan raw diet. You know, it's like going to be some kind of a tortilla made out of sprouted stuff mixed with nuts that are ground and or something. You know, that kind of raw, right? Maybe you're talking about like sushi or something like that. Well, this kind of had some of that in the sense of like this. So this was this is what they mean by a raw bar, I guess, like on the East Coast and over into that culture over into here is, it was like, you know, cooked but chilled shrimp, like big plates of shrimp and shrimp cod and smoked salmon and all that. And then they had, a bunch of different kinds of oysters and all this stuff. And then they had, and mussels. And it was kind of a seafood thing. You know, they had a big salad bar and they did have some prime rib out and some stuff, but it was spectacular. And I don't even know who to thank because I'm not sure who was that invited us to go. The consultant got included in this fundraising dinner or whatever it was. And But it was amazing. I ate so many oysters. It's like I love oysters on the half shell. And you get the little, and you know, sometimes if they're really different, really, if there's a bunch of, there's only one kind of oyster that had actually, they had some mussels and they had some oysters. And after I've tasted a couple of them, it's like, if I'm doing like an oyster tasting, like there's a bunch of different oysters, you know what? Funny coincidence. The last time I ate a bunch of oysters was in an oyster eating contest that I got in. And I was thinking about this last night, and it was in, I think, Kennewick, Washington. It was that same trip that I went through the tiny airport and got my bag torn apart. Weird coincidence. I'm sorry. Yes, that's me. I get distracted by coincidences like that. So, but no, it's great. Now you get to like the lemon juice and a little dollop of horseradish, a little bit of cocktail sauce on these oysters and like slurp them down. Another thing that I never would have thought I'd see myself doing when I was younger, but oysters, raw oysters, spectacular. So it was just a glorious spread of food. It had mussels and some stuff and these fried oysters and all this. But it's interesting. It's interesting being in an environment like a golf club like that where everybody there is kind of, they've done well for themselves. And everybody at our table we were talking to clearly had done well for themselves, and they were very generous and very much, they really care about the common good. They want to see people do well and they want to see the city come back. They want to see, you know, it was great. It's a very different culture than I'm from. There was a time in my life when I would have been very, very, very uncomfortable around people that have some money, you know, cause I was raised with just not much money. We weren't like dirt poor or anything, but I was raised by a single mom and, I came home to the lights having been turned off a couple of times. I mean, that was, you know, we weren't members of the tennis club or the golf club growing up, you know. And, but it was nice. I've kind of, over the course of my life, I've learned to be a little more comfortable around different kinds of people. And it's funny, that's one of the kind of people I've learned to be comfortable around and how to communicate with. And we just had a spectacular time. I was just taken care of so well, just such good hospitality. But it was just kind of, you know, it's kind of old school, you know, some of these golf clubs. I mean, this is, you know, this golf club was like kind of old school, you know, the way the bar was laid out and what they were serving was probably, you know, it was just kind of classic, you know? And so we went downstairs and had an amazing, fun conversation about history with one of these guys. And, he pointed out something that I had not thought about, that if you haven't heard about it, look up the origin of the St. Michael prayer. So, I think it was Pope Leo the 12th, Leo the 13th, Leo the 13th, one of the Leos, was Pope, and he was in adoration and prayer one day, and he just like had this vision, like he heard these voices, a guttural voice and a sweet voice, and it was a scene like out of the beginning of the Book of Job, where Satan had gone to go in to meet with God, and he says, you know, God's like, have you considered my servant Job? It was a scene like that, but it was a guttural voice and a sweet voice. And the guttural voice was like, you know, if I had enough time and enough power, I could destroy your church. I could destroy everything that and the other sweet voice was like, well, how long do you think you would need? And he says, if you give me a century with enough power, I can do it. And the sweet voice said, okay, fine, you have one century to do your worst. And the Pope passed out, like, and they had to use smelling salts to revive him, right? And then he went and he composed the two prayers. He composed the St. Michael prayer, the short form that they used to say at the end of every low mass up into Vatican II, and you're starting to see it make a comeback. You know, the St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle, be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the Heavenly Hosts, by the power of God, cast into hell Satan and all evil spirits who prowl about the world seeking the ruin of souls. Amen. He wrote that prayer. And then he wrote the longer version of it, which is like is an exorcism. It's in the exorcism. Think about what's happened in the last 100 years. 2 world wars, just all this just absolute, just rampant, horrible stuff, right? Just terrible. This has been one of the bloodiest, nastiest, most brutal centuries, and just culture has just gone off the rails and abandoned God, the sexual revolution, and it's just exponentially getting worse and worse now. It is craziness, right? But then he pointed out just something so obvious. The devil asked and was given a century. That was, I think, October 13th, 1917. So next year, 2017, will be 100 years. That will be the end of a century that he was given to do his works. Now, I don't know. None of this is like de fide, like you have to believe it or anything. But I find that interesting. As bad as things have gotten and as how exponentially weird it's getting, that I wonder what's going to happen next year on that date. And he had a bigger theory about all this amazing stuff that had happened in these very particular intervals between this one date and everything. But just that was the one snippet. This guy remembered numbers like nobody I've ever seen. He could tell you every date of any time anybody was born, what an event happened, boom, boom, boom. And at some point he just kind of says, I guess you could tell numbers stick. I'm like, numbers do not stick with me, man. Details and numbers are not my forte. But I don't even remember the exact dates. But anyway, next year, I know it's 1917 because it's 2017. So that will be 100 years since Satan was given 100 years. Now, like I said, that's not like doctrine. It's not something you have to believe. It's not, if you're listening to this and you're going, oh, come on, you really believe in that kind of stuff? Eh. Yeah, I kind of do, but I find that interesting. Anyway, overall, golf club, glorious. The just old school feast, man. And what was, speaking of old school, the last thing I tell you about the golf club, we went downstairs, we're in the kind of like the little like sports pub, kind of closing the night down, watching some football and having this conversation about history and stuff, right? So I get up, I go to the bathroom. Dude, this bathroom is like a snapshot into a former time. Not so much just like the layout of it or like the way it's decorated, but they have like all this like product on a shelf, you know, like when you go to clubs or something where they, you know, if you go to like a health club or something or some kind of a club, remember like the Fort Collins Club, whenever I used to, my family had a membership up there when I was living in Fort Collins, you would go there and they have like product out, you know, like some, and there, so there's like Vitalis, like hair tonic, Brute cologne, like all this like stuff that's like so old school, man. It was like a snapshot to like the 70s, dude. Oh my gosh. Just like all the stuff that, and I guess it's cause, you know, it's the, a lot of the guys who are members, that's what they like cause that's when they grew up, you know, but it's like, it's just so funny. You never go along some, it's just that weird environment of like class, like really nice, but like old school. And it was never more. I took a picture. I literally took a picture of the product selection all over the shelf in front of the sinks in the bathroom because I hadn't seen any of this stuff like in public in a long time. Vitalis and like hair tonic. I mean, just absolutely hilarious. There you go. The counter position. Man, this is the set of topics you heard about today. This is the only place, for better or worse. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counter Position. Thanks for coming out.
I take your place in my old stone. I take your place in my old stone.